From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. We're very thankful for that support. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Tuesday is the Christian observance of Candlemas, the presentation of Christ in the temple. It's also the Wicca pagan celebration of Imbolc Lugnasad. Thursday is Set Sebun Sai for followers of the Shinto tradition, as well as the Christian feast of St. Blaise. This week, the week leading up to the first in the nation Iowa caucuses on Monday, saw an unrelenting media focus on the so-called evangelical vote in that state. Senator Ted Cruz courted that vote with a closed-door meeting with hundreds of Iowa pastors, warning that Donald Trump would be the GOP caucus winner unless they, those pastors, tell their congregations to vote for him. Trump, meanwhile, escalated his petty feud with the Fox News television network, skipping Thursday's debate and likely costing the network millions in the process by counter-programming with his own high-profile Iowa event. And Bernie Sanders has spoken more extensively about the role religious faith plays in his life and politics this week, more than he previously has. Widely seen as a historically secular candidate, Sanders, in fact, speaks of the topic in a way that is likely to be both comforting and familiar to both religious progressives and to Americans of no religious faith. Hillary Clinton has also talked elaborately about the role of faith in her life and in her politics. There's no question that the primary election needs to be our focus today. And so, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Of the Republicans surveyed by Pew, 44% said Trump is either very religious or somewhat religious, while 47% said the real estate mogul is either not too religious or not at all religious. The findings are the latest of Pew's research on the impact of religion on presidential campaigns.
The always valuable Pew Center for Religion and Public Life has just released a new survey of American voters and religion. How important is a candidate's faith? What aspects of a shared religion are most important? What influence is the focus on faith this cycle likely to have on bringing voters to the polls or on keeping them at home? Later in the hour, I'll talk with Pew's Jessica Martinez.
I always say a deep, deep second to the Bible. The Bible is the best, the Bible.
But if an extra 10 million evangelical Christians show up on Election Day, we will not be up at 2 or 3 in the morning wondering what happened in Ohio or Florida.
Ted Cruz is my man. I'm voting for him.
The son of an evangelical pastor, Texas Senator Ted Cruz, has been working overtime to position himself as this election's conservative Christian candidate and to earn endorsements from sometimes controversial religious right figures. Journalist Sarah Posner has been keeping close watch over the relationship between candidates and organized religion this season, and she'll be with us once again to share her observations.
There is no way to describe these new New Hampshire numbers other than stunning. Bernie Sanders, that Democratic Socialist senator from Vermont, now has nearly double the support.
The issues are different in New Hampshire than they are in Iowa. And with just over a week to go until the first primary in the nation, it's important to understand those differences, because the first few states greatly influence the campaigns going forward. You'll hear from Neil Levesque, director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. But first,
my question is for atheist voters that are looking for somebody that will uphold their rights as Americans and not pander to a certain religious group. My question is, how do you plan on upholding our rights and focusing on non-theists?
To watch the news, You'd think Iowa was a homogeneous voting bloc of evangelical Christians. But like in every other part of the country, the truth is far more complicated than that. Doing something that I don't hesitate to call both vital and patriotic, activist Justin Scott has challenged a number of presidential candidates regarding their approach to non-religious Iowans and Americans. We mentioned his against-the-grain questioning of Marco Rubio and Carly Fiorina on last week's show, and this week, I'm happy to say, we're welcoming Justin Scott to State of Belief Radio. Justin, welcome.
Yeah, thank you so much. I appreciate being invited onto the show.
What's the focus of questions that you've addressed to the various candidates?
Well, it first started off just to try to raise awareness for the non-theistic viewpoint, both here in Iowa and across the country. American Atheists is putting out an effort called Atheist Voter, where they are trying to get non-theistic voters out in front of these candidates. And I thought, why can't I do that? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty easy.
Uh-huh.
So it first started with just a simple question of how do you plan to uphold and or strengthen the separation of church and state?
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of evolved as I started going to different events for different candidates where I would actually do some research on each candidate to find out, you know, maybe if there's one or two big things that they focus on from a religious standpoint and how that affects their leadership. And I would actually start to tailor my questions to each candidate.
Mm-hmm. Did the people around you, when you asked the question, seem to be surprised that you were asking that question?
Oh, absolutely. It was basically as if I had stood up and asked, you know, would you vote for a purple unicorn? I don't think anybody in the rooms that I had been in had ever even seen an atheist in person, let alone heard somebody stand up and say, hi, I'm an atheist, and I have a question.
Yeah, and you could talk intelligently.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, that's one of the biggest things I've been trying to do is I can talk until I'm blue in the face to these voters and these candidates about the virtues of being a non-theistic American in Iowan. I can say that I'm a regular guy. You know, I run mm-hmm. a small business. I'm a father. I'm a husband. But I think sometimes it's how you act and how you treat people that mean more mm-hmm. than anything you can say. Because I can sit there and say, well, atheists are this way, and then all of a sudden act a different way, and people are going to say, well, I don't care what you say. Look at how you acted. But
right. yeah.
with the Marco Rubio exchange and the video that I've put up there that's gone super viral in just the last week, people have gotten to see that an atheist in Iowa is respectful, you know, asking very well thought out questions, and isn't just there to throw tomatoes at the candidate and scream and get kicked out and mm-hmm. all of those tired and old stereotypes about what non-believers are and how
yeah.
they act.
Which candidates have been cooperative candidates you've gotten answers from?
So far, I have been able to challenge 9 different candidates, ranging from Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump to Ted Cruz to Bernie Sanders. And so far, Donald Trump has been the only one that has flat out ignored me. I was standing 6 inches from him. He was signing an autograph for me. He took a selfie with me. I asked him the question. He nodded. And then he just stood there. And he didn't respond. He didn't say anything. And so I, you know, respectfully said, Mr. Trump, did you happen to hear me? And he kind of just stood there and he stood there. And finally, when he handed me the autographed picture, I said, Mr. Trump, again, my question. And he reaches out and he taps me on the arm and he says, you take care now. And he moves on. Mm. And so, you know, I've been very appreciative of all the time and consideration that a lot of these candidates have given me on both sides of the aisle. For the most part, they've taken my question head on.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw Secretary Clinton in Cedar Falls, Iowa, and she was working the fence line after her event. And when I put the question out there, she didn't keep walking. She didn't keep signing autographs. And she didn't try walking away. I mean, she literally stopped what she was doing, looked me in the eyes, and gave me a very good answer. So, you know, for the most part, I haven't had any pushback. I've had no candidate mock me. I've had no candidate roll their eyes and say, oh, you're just one of them atheists, whatever. So it's been fun.
What would you consider to be the best and the worst answers that you've heard so far?
Without making it a polar issue, because that's not what I want. I'm not going into this looking to be divisive, and I'm not looking to just stir up controversy. You know, what I want first and foremost is just dialogue. In terms of the best answer, I think it starts with just a willingness to take on my question and take it seriously. Mm-hmm. I think that is the foundation of a good dialogue between people of different faiths and beliefs and lack of beliefs. Mm-hmm. I will say in terms of the worst answers, it's not so much that what they've said, but it's kind of the overall, like when they say read between the lines, I've had some candidates that want to focus on, instead of saying how they are going to stand up for the separation of church and state, they want to reference the First Amendment, and they want to say, well, it's your right to be an atheist. And it's like, well, really, you don't say, you know, I've been on this earth for 34 years, and I've known that it's my right to do a whole bunch of things. I don't need a reminder of that. What I need is an answer to my questions about very specific issues.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, on one side, I compliment Marco Rubio for taking on my question. On the other side, I do feel that he went into kind of a sermon mode and talked more about his beliefs and tried to pander to those evangelical voters in the room rather than just saying, you know what, I'll make sure no one discriminates against you. I'll make sure that, you know, your viewpoint is listened to and things like that. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily good versus bad. It's just, did we push the conversation forward? Did both sides feel like they came out of it benefiting from it?
What did candidate Cruz say? How did he treat you?
I'm not going to lie. As I walked into the building and I noticed that it was a tiny coffee shop and it was packed, you know, my heart started racing because I realized that as an atheist, I'm standing around a bunch of people that do not see things the way I see them. And as he walked in, I realized that Bob Vanderplaats and Steve King from Sioux City, mm-hmm. two of the most staunch believing leaders in the state of Iowa, who many would say go against a secular viewpoint or an atheist viewpoint, mm-hmm. Had actually joined him. So I knew that now the stakes had been raised because now I'm going to be addressing not only Mr. Cruz, but these two as well. They get the crowd worked up, and then Mr. Cruz comes in, and he gets the crowd worked up into this God-loving, anti-Obama, grab-your-guns, grab-your-Bible type of, you know, frenzy. So he says, does anybody have any questions? And immediately I stick my hand in the air, and I say, Mr. Cruz, I do. And before he can even call on me, I said, you know, you've said a lot of things that have been disparaging against non-believers. Why should an atheist like me vote for a person like you? And there was this moment where I just said in my head, like, okay, the question's out there. Hold on tight.
Yeah.
When I first started and I said, hi, I'm an atheist, you could just tell the people there, I mean, they just turned and looked like with giant eyes, like, what is this, you know?
So what did he say?
You know, he answered it in a very well-performed, well-rehearsed manner. He talked about, again, it was my right to be an atheist, but it's his right to be a Christian. And I could tell that he was starting to pander a little bit to the religious voters in the room.
Mm-hmm.
He started talking about how Christians are being persecuted and things like that. And at one point, he even asked me to come join him in becoming a Christian. Well, the funniest part is that I grew up a Christian. I was baptized Catholic. I was baptized Lutheran. And so I've already been down that road, and I've already experienced that. And so I didn't need to hear that from him. What I really wanted to hear was, what was his plan to uphold the rights of all Americans?
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded more like he had grabbed his religious freedom speech and kind of just threw it at me. And so, you know, in a perfect world, he would have given me an answer of, I have my faith, everyone else has their faith, and I'm going to do what I can to help everybody. But the sense I got was that, I'm a Christian and you're not, and if you're not with me, well then, you're on the other side.
Justin Scott is the communications chair for the Iowa chapter of the Secular Coalition for America. This campaign season, he's boldly questioned a number of presidential candidates on their positions regarding non-religious Americans and their rights in a religion-soaked political season. Justin, this has been a real pleasure to talk with you. You're doing vitally important work for Iowans and for democracy. Thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Yeah, thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
New Hampshire voters head to the polls on Tuesday, February 9th. As the first primary of the election cycle, it helps determine which candidates get the media coverage and the money in the following months. For a look at how the process is shaping up this year, I'm delighted to be joined by Neil Levesque, director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics. Neil, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Well, I'm happy to be on, Wilton.
Well, all the talk about Iowa tends to focus on the impact of religious voters. What are the most important blocks in New Hampshire?
I've often thought that New Hampshire voters are trying to pick a president for all 50 states. Mm-hmm. And that's why you can have someone like a Jimmy Carter who comes up from the South with 2% in the polls and can win the New Hampshire primary with 26% of the vote. So the big issues, I think, for Republican primary voters might be the general reaction of the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. And on the Democratic side, I think Bernie Sanders in particular is sort of doing a lot of reaction about the system is rigged against you as a citizen, and mm-hmm. we need to change that.
From where you sit, who's connecting most effectively with these different groups in New Hampshire?
Well, for 32 weeks, we've seen that Donald Trump has a double-digit lead in polls. He certainly is hitting some type of vibe. Then you have Ted Cruz, who's right behind him, and then what we have been referring to as the Fab Four. They're not the Beatles, but Kasich, Bush, Rubio, and Christie. Mm-hmm. If you added up the votes for those four people, as far as polling goes, they would be in the lead. That one person would be in the lead, but they're splitting that vote. So I think that sort of those four people are really hitting some of the points for New Hampshire primary voters.
Mm-hmm. How significant is Bernie Sanders' lead in New Hampshire polling, and how big a deal would it be going forward if he defeats Hillary Clinton there next week?
Well, I think every one of these candidates, especially Hillary Clinton, would like to win Iowa and New Hampshire and then kind of be done with it. But at this point, the polling indicates that may not happen. Mm-hmm. Sanders will get a lot of momentum if he wins New Hampshire. He'll get a lot of money, and then on to South Carolina. She has a significant lead in South Carolina. We've seen this before. John McCain and George W. Bush. Mm-hmm. McCain won New Hampshire by 19 points, but then they went to South Carolina, where George W. Bush really took the gloves off. Mm-hmm. I think that Hillary really has a good campaign going here. So what I always like to say is that it's always wise to buy Clinton stock when it's low.
I see. Religious liberty issues raised by candidates like Trump or Cruz, will they pay attention to that, or is that just not that important?
I think it's very important. I just don't think it's talked about so mm-hmm. much in New Hampshire as it is would be in other states. I think that faith here is deep, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of people of faith, and that may be why they are motivated to vote the way they do. Mm. But they don't necessarily talk about it so much.
Sure.
And so it's hard to identify those voters. You'll see candidates go to Iowa, and they will use religious phrases in their stump speech. Mm-hmm. The same candidate will come to New Hampshire, and they'll omit that. Mm-hmm. Of course, sophisticated voters know, as we have here in New Hampshire, sophisticated voters, they're watching all of this. And I think that candidates and their faith, their backgrounds, are all things that voters here in New Hampshire are weighing. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because, you know, we saw Donald Trump go to church last week in Iowa. He didn't go to church in New Hampshire, but we saw him on television do it. Mm-hmm. He was making a statement.
Sure. Are there significant ways that the primaries are shaping up this year that are different from previous election cycles?
On the Sanders insurgency, it's rather interesting that someone who has not been a Democrat is running to be the leader of the Democratic Party. and his message, which is that the system is rigged against you, is almost an indictment of who would be in power now, which is Barack Obama. So that's a sort of strange situation that I see. Mm-hmm. The second phenomenon is we have this nationally known person, Donald Trump, running, who doesn't need to be campaigning in New Hampshire, but he has. He takes questions all the time. He's been hard at it. The other thing that we see is undeclared voters, so what we would normally call an independent voter, mm-hmm. can vote in New Hampshire. It's different than other states. And so the undeclareds are saying, Trump is our first choice, and if we couldn't vote for him, we'd vote for Sanders, which is amazing because there are two people on the opposite sides of the ideological spectrum.
Yeah.
But the answer you get with a voter like that is they're going to shake up the system and they're not part of it, which is really amazing. I think Americans continue to be fed up with their elected officials and government in general, and this is a reaction to that. A lot of the times, you know, politicians can get to the point where they're almost empty vessels that individuals fill with their own heart, you know, desires. So in 2008, some people voted for Barack Obama for change. Of course, change is a very subjective thing. And you fill that up with what you as a voter want to see for change. And so, you know, in the Sanders-Trump thing, it's sort of like somebody who's opposed to the powers that be.
Mm-hmm.
And so every time, say, for example, Trump says, I'm bucking Fox and I'm not going to join their debate, you know, he's adding to that same narrative, which is, I can say no even to Fox News.
Neil, what does the national media not get about the dynamics of New Hampshire politics? And what should our listeners know that they're not being told on the evening news?
You know, Donald Trump for 32 weeks has led with a double-digit lead, and a lot of national people have said, well, this is not going to last, he's going to screw up, he won't make it, he won't make it. Well, the facts are the facts, and sometimes someone needs to say, he's actually good at this. Mm-hmm. He's talented at the promotion of politics and running for president, and he does have a solid lead, and you don't see that in the national pundits at all. I think their distaste of Trump and Cruz is palatable.
Mm-hmm.
But remember, they're commanding a lot of the Republican electoral votes. So we'll see if they get a big surprise here.
Yeah. Do you think there are going to be surprises in either Iowa or New Hampshire? And how do you see the first part of this whole cycle working out?
I think this is working exactly the way it should be, in the fact that these candidates are campaigning against each other hard here in New Hampshire,
mm-hmm.
and it's an even playing field for them. Is there going to be surprises? There always are. If I were a listener, I'd be looking for who's going to win Iowa? Is there a second place finisher in Iowa? And who is that? And what is the big surprise between Iowa and New Hampshire? So we're looking basically from Tuesday to Tuesday of next week,
mm-hmm.
where there's a lot of activity. They're all in the same little quadrant of the world, and there's always some big New Hampshire moment, and that's what I'd be looking for in this race.
Neil Levesque is director of the New Hampshire Institute of Politics and Political Library at St. Anselm College. The Institute has hosted numerous presidential primary debates and other important political fora. Neil, great thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio and enlightening us from your experiences and observations. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Welton.
At this point in an election year, we're inundated with various polls, all seeking to predict what might happen when voters finally get to the ballot box. But very often, much more insight can be gained from looking closely at the convictions guiding voter preferences rather than the particular candidates they say they plan to support. The Pew Research Center does invaluable work in analyzing the role that religious preferences play in voter behavior. And I am delighted to welcome senior researcher Jessica Martinez to State of Belief Radio. Jessica, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
What are the most noteworthy findings in the just-released Pew Faith and the 2016 campaign survey?
Specifically, we've asked some questions about some of the 2016 presidential candidates, including how religious people think candidates are and how good a president they might make if they're elected. Mm-hmm. And so we find that generally more Americans see the GOP presidential candidates as religious than say the same about Democratic candidates. For example, roughly two-thirds of Americans think Ben Carson and Ted Cruz are either very or somewhat religious people. About 6 in 10 say the same about Marco Rubio, compared to about half who say this about Hillary Clinton and 4 in 10 who say it about Sanders. And the exception to this pattern is Donald Trump. Only about 3 in 10 Americans think Trump is at least somewhat religious, and that's lower than the share who say this about the other candidates we asked about.
I find the correlation between evangelical Christianity and dislike of the Democratic candidates particularly striking. Are these levels of opposition typical, or is this a particularly polarized year?
What we're finding is that there's a partisan divide in how religious people think the candidates are. And what I mean by that is Republicans tend to think that the Republican candidates are religious at higher rates than Democrats, mm-hmm. and vice versa. Democrats think the Democratic candidates are religious mm-hmm. at higher rates than the Republicans. And white evangelical voters are one of the groups that most consistently identifies with the Republican Party. So that might be some of what you're seeing there in mm-hmm. their views of the Democratic candidates. It's both a political and maybe a religious outlook.
I see. Another thing that stood out for me was the disdain for an atheist candidacy. Lack of religious faith is still, sadly, the most unpopular characteristic of the potential candidate for the White House. But I want to highlight how much that number has changed in just a few years. Would you talk about that, please?
Right. So we ask about a list of potential characteristics of presidential candidates and whether these things would make someone more or less likely to support a candidate or whether it wouldn't matter. And being an atheist or, you know, someone not believing in God, that's one of the biggest liabilities that Americans see among a potential presidential candidate. So about half of people say they would be less likely to vote for someone who doesn't believe in God. And that's higher shares than say the same thing about, you know, someone who's had an extramarital affair in the past or mm-hmm. someone who's used marijuana in the past. But as you mentioned, we've seen some change in this question over time. So as recently as 2007, more than 6 in 10 said they'd be less likely to support an atheist mm-hmm. Compared to just half now. And the share saying it wouldn't matter to them either way has grown over that short period of time.
Hmm. What comes out as the biggest surprises in the findings of the Pew Faith and the 2016 campaign survey?
In general, being seen as a religious person seems to be an asset for the potential presidential candidates. You know, nearly all Republican or Republican-leaning registered voters who think that Cruz or Rubio or Carson would be either a good or great president, mm-hmm. they also say that they view those candidates as at least somewhat religious. But when it comes to Trump, again, he's an exception here. There are many Republicans who think that Trump would be a good or great president despite the fact that they perceive him as not being a religious person.
Mm-hmm. This is a surprise. Do your numbers show why this is a surprise?
People bring their faith to these decisions, but mm-hmm. there are also many other factors that come into play when people are evaluating potential presidential candidates. And mm-hmm. so this survey doesn't go deeply into some of the other factors that might be coming into play, but it does suggest that religion, while important for many, is not the only thing that's on people's minds when it comes to evaluating the potential presidential candidates.
That's a very good reminder, and I appreciate you saying that. Are there other trends that emerge in the survey responses this time?
Whether or not people think that political leaders have been expressing too much or too little religious faith and prayer. And we find that about 4 in 10 Americans say there's been too little of this kind of talk from political leaders, compared to 27% who say there's been too much. And while this hasn't changed a lot since 2014 when we last asked it, if you look back at 2012, the last time we were in a presidential election cycle, these figures have reversed. At that time, more people said there was too much religious talk from political leaders than said there was too little.
That is very interesting. Overall, does this survey suggest that the intense media focus on religious issues and coverage of this year's presidential campaign is appropriate?
You know, it's hard to say. We find that roughly half of people say it's important to them to have a president that share their religious beliefs, and so it is one of many important factors that, people are thinking about. We find that a majority of Americans continue to think that religion is losing influence on American life, including half of people who think this is a bad thing. And as I just mentioned, there's a growing share of people who think there's too little religious expression from political leaders. So there's certainly an interest from many Americans in having a role for religion in politics and in public life.
Jessica, is there anything else in the survey that our listeners should pay particular attention to as they look at religion and the 2016 campaigns?
There's definitely more in the survey, so I'd encourage people to take a look at it. Our website is pewresearch.org, and from there you can find the report, which is titled Faith in the 2016 Campaign, and you can look through all of the findings there on the web or download the PDF file for yourself.
Jessica Martinez is a senior researcher at Pew. Pew has just released the eye-opening findings of its Faith and the 2016 campaign survey. Jessica, I know you're busy. I thank you so much for being with us today, sharing this information with our listeners on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Investigative journalist Sarah Posner has been writing extensively on the relationship between conservative Christian leaders and national political candidates, and she's been doing that for a long time. And the current election cycle just begs for that kind of expertise. So I'm very happy to be able to welcome Sarah back to State of Belief once again. Sarah, thanks for being with us once more.
Thank you for having me again, Welton.
Let's start with Donald Trump. He can't keep up with the likes of Ted Cruz in terms of conservative Christian credentials. But you've written, most recently in Rolling Stone magazine as well as in the New York Times, about his popularity with those voters. Would you talk about that, please? I don't understand it.
This week, he got a very coveted endorsement from Jerry Falwell Jr., the son of the Moral Majority founder and the president of Liberty University. Now, of course, Falwell doesn't represent all evangelicals. Let's just put that on the table right now. Mm-hmm. But it does signal that there are a significant number of evangelicals who are supporting Trump, and polling data bears that out. It bears it out in Iowa, bears that out in South Carolina, national polling data bears it out as well. And the only explanation that I can come up with for why, despite being not religious and in many ways thumbing his nose at the concerns of religious conservatives, Trump has managed to draw their attention because they're perhaps more interested in making America great, quote unquote, than mm-hmm. they are in making America Christian, which has long been their goal.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any of these could go sour on him rather than helpful, the endorsements he's received?
Well, as much as he has support of white evangelicals, I think that there are a great many evangelicals who are quite disgusted with the evangelical embrace of Trump. It remains to be seen whether those people are going to outnumber the pro-Trump evangelicals. Mm-hmm. I think you would have to see a consolidation of them around one particular alternative in most likely Rubio or Cruz for them to defeat Trump, I think. I mean, if the polling data continues to go in the direction that it's going.
What happened to Mike Huckabee? So much of this normally would be right in his wheelhouse, but he finds himself totally marginalized this year.
I think evangelicals are looking for, and I hate to use this word, a winner, not a loser, right? Mike Huckabee once ran. So is Rick Santorum. They're the two people who won the Iowa caucuses in 2008 and 2012, and it appears that evangelicals are not interested in seeing them run again. So their history, and no matter how much they appeal to the religious sensibilities of Iowa evangelicals, they're getting nowhere. I think Iowa evangelicals want to see a new face. Now, whether that face turns out to be Trump or Cruz or less likely Rubio remains to be seen, but it's very clear that they want something new. And Iowa's going to come down to a battle between the sort of Christian nationalists, dominionists who support Ted Cruz, and the supporters of Trump who are basically looking for that, you know, take no prisoners, I'm the winner, I'm going to send all the immigrants back to Mexico, and I'm going to be different than Barack Obama and keep the Muslims out, et cetera, et cetera. It's going to come down to a battle between those two camps.
Are they just saying religion doesn't matter, or are they saying that we are in a situation in which change politically is more important than religious concerns?
I think that we're in a stage where the religious right has been told by their leaders for so many years that we need a revival, we need Christian leaders, we need great Christian leaders in government, we need elected officials in government who are going to govern from their biblical values. They've been hearing that over and over and over again. And when do they ever actually see that happen? I mean, sure, they have Christian leaders in government, or what they would consider to be Christian leaders in government, but then they got the same-sex marriage decision, which has really thrown them through a loop. They haven't yet been able to criminalize abortion. There still is, legally speaking, a separation of church and state. So maybe they're thinking, all this talk about biblical values and governing from a biblical worldview hasn't really worked out for us. So we want to go with a winner. We want to go with somebody who just sort of basically understands at a gut level that America is under threat by, quote unquote, enemies. And that person doesn't have to specify those enemies as being secularists or feminists. He exhibits that in his behavior towards women, his behavior towards Megyn Kelly even, his discussion of Muslims being a threat to America. So he taps into those anxieties without using the religion. And since these voters have not really seen the entanglement of religion and politics work out so well for them, maybe they're willing to just go for that.
Sarah, you recently wrote about the way the Democratic candidates have addressed or avoided talking about faith. There was a striking exchange with Hillary Clinton where you say she missed a great opportunity. Talk about that for a second.
Well, she was asked by a voter at a campaign stop in Iowa how her views lined up with the Ten Commandments. And this voter wanted a way of being able to tell her conservative Christian Republican friends why she was voting for Clinton. She wanted to be able to justify that to her Republican friends. And Secretary Clinton gave an extended soliloquy about her Methodist faith and what that means to her, which I suppose answered this voter's question. And like I said, when I wrote about this, there was a lot to admire about what she said. She talked about, you know, Christianity being wrongly used to judge people and the sorts of ways that she views her own Christianity in a less judgmental light. But she did not say anything about, well, we do not have religious tests for presidents under the Constitution, and we have separation of church and state under the Constitution, so I'm not going to govern from a particular religious viewpoint because that's not constitutional. And, you know, you shouldn't create these religious tests for the presidency because that's also not constitutional, even while I can still hold these very intense religious beliefs that guide me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think those things are not all incompatible with each other, but she just did not address the constitutional question.
I understand.
And I understand why she didn't.
Yeah. What about Bernie Sanders? A lot of analysts are saying his secularism is actually more historically significant in a modern-day candidate than even his Jewish heritage is. What about him?
Well, I don't think that most Bernie Sanders supporters are looking for him to talk about religion. He did talk about religion, interestingly enough, when he spoke at Liberty University, something Hillary Clinton hasn't done. And he was basically saying, look, you know, you people, you evangelicals, you read the Bible, and in the Bible there's a lot of stuff that supports my positions on economic issues. It was sort of an interesting take, given that he's a secular person. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't shy there about talking about his support for a woman's right to choose. And I think it's interesting that people are kind of fixated on his secularism, but not on Donald Trump's secularism, because Donald Trump really is. I mean, he likes to say that he's a Presbyterian, and he likes to say that he loves the evangelicals, but really, the entirety of his adult life has been extremely secular.
Mm-hmm. Sarah Posner is a prolific journalist covering religion and politics, and I really encourage you to follow her at sarahposner.com. Sarah is also the author of the book, God's Prophets, Profits, Faith, Fraud, and the Republican Crusade for Values Voters. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us once again on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Wilton, for having me again.
Now, before we go, I want to share with you something good, something positive. For the last several weeks, news that makes us feel good or current events that evoke gratitude have been in critically short supply. The threats of terrorism and candidates for the presidency of our nation acting like pouting grade school students or bullies who must get their way or not play. So I've been thinking a lot about the decision on Planned Parenthood handed down earlier this week by a Houston grand jury. Ever since a highly troubling and equally questionable film was released, ostensibly documenting charges that Planned Parenthood had been harvesting and selling body parts of fetuses, hardly a day has gone by that we've not heard bitter denunciations of that organization several times during the day. Thankfully, even under siege, Planned Parenthood has continued its irreplaceable offering of health care for women who otherwise actually just wouldn't have health care. My friend Cecile Richards, leader of Planned Parenthood, was called before a congressional hearing and hounded by unfounded accusations about the agency's work. Numerous members of Congress have called for defunding Planned Parenthood. The organization and its supporters have been called all kinds of bad names and labeled immoral. Now remember, all of this took place prior to any report based on a serious investigation about the charges or the credibility of the incendiary film. Well, earlier this week, as you may know, Devon Anderson, the district attorney in Harris County, Texas, announced that after an investigation of the charges leveled at Planned Parenthood by the producers of the scurrilous film that was supposed to provide evidence of criminal activity, after an investigation, there were no laws broken by Planned Parenthood, and the film was a fake, a collection of clips carefully spliced together to turn truth into a lie. Instead of indicting Planned Parenthood because of the film, The producers of the film were indicted for a felony, fraud, and more. Now, finally, something went right, I thought. The justice system worked. Compassionate medical care was affirmed, and lies that hurt and kill people were challenged. Appropriately, final decisions about the guilt, criminal activity, and charges in this case will be made in the courts. The blanket of lies spread across our nation have been exposed for what they were, though many individuals in high places will conveniently ignore the findings of the grand jury. Sadly, the power of untruth and its consequences remain. We cannot bring back the lives of innocent people killed by a man inflamed with anger resulting from the lies perpetuated even in the halls of our government. Prejudice prompts violence. Hate speech kills as it incites sick minds to justify murder. Yes, we already know that truth appears not to matter among people who thrive on hatred. That's an ongoing problem with no good consequences. But friends, it is nice, it is encouraging, it is inspiring to see truth win out over lies. Something good to happen when so many people wanted things to go badly, and justice in our nation to prevail, even though the causes of justice and truth will continue to need all of the support that we can offer. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with that person. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long online, too. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and engage in the discussion. We'd love to hear from you. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. It's getting crowded there. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
Preacher man, you see what?